We'll call to order the, what is today? March 30th, Thursday, Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee. There are two items before us today. The first item is House File 2366, and we do not have a quorum yet, so I will not be able to officially move it before the committee. This will be an informational hearing, and Representative Eklund, we'll start with you in just a minute. And our second item is going to be that of the Campaign Finance Board. So when we get folks here, we'll take care of the minutes, and we'll also officially move the bill. But Representative Eklund, we will give you a chance to start with the presentation of your bill. Good morning, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for granting this hearing request kind of on short notice. House File 2366 proposes a transfer of the Minnesota State Historic Preservation Office. I'll refer to it as SHPO from here on out, because that's a lot of, that's a mouthful. But anyway, to the Department of Administration. I feel it's good government reform will put Minnesota in line with how other states handle their important historical preservation work. One of the main functions of this office, Mr. Chair, members, is to assist federal and state agencies in carrying out their historic preservation duties. They often work with the DNR, PCA, the U.S. Forest Service, U.S. Army Corps, and others in this function. 48 states currently have the SHPO office in their Department of Administration. Only Minnesota and Ohio do not. Over the past couple of years, there have been concerns with the operations and the work of this office, the slowness of work, difficulty meeting deadlines, and keeping projects from moving forward, and difficulty interacting with state and federal agencies to keep projects moving towards completion. Concerns with SHPO are shared by cities, nonprofits, and private businesses. This transfer will create and accountability to the office to help correct these issues. With me today is Bill Hefner, an attorney from the Environmental Law Group, a firm here in Minnesota who has extensive experience representing various clients who have struggled with their interactions with SHPO. Also here today is a representative from the Department of Administration, and he will talk to the transfer issues. And I would also like to note that the governor supports this legislation, and with that, I'll turn it over to my testifier, Mr. Chair.
Representative Eklund, thank you for the setup of the bill. We do now have a quorum, so I'm going to just take a little bit of administrative housekeeping here. I officially will move House File 2366 before the committee. It is an informational hearing, so we will not be taking action, but it is now officially before the committee. And Representative Fenton, have you had a chance to review the minutes from the March 21st? Oh, there she is. Minutes. You were the last one to walk in. It was going to be Jessup until you walked in. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I have, and I move the minutes from March 21st.
Members, any corrections to the minutes from March 21st? Seeing none and hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion carries. Well, now, Mr. Hefner, welcome to the committee. You'll introduce yourself and identify who you're with and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Bill Hefner. I am an attorney with the Environmental Law Group here in Minnesota. Briefly, my law firm, it's a small environmental law boutique. We represent a variety of clients, both public and private. On the public side, we represent everything from small local governments to large quasi-governmental agencies. On the private side, we represent everything from mom-and-pop organizations to international clients. It is in that capacity that I've had the experience of representing clients who have gone through the federal Section 106 process and had experience interacting with SHPO. That said, I feel I need to make it clear for the record that I am here in my own capacity. I'm not here on behalf of any clients, and because of that, while I'll be sharing my experiences in representing clients, I will not be naming names of those clients because, again, they've not asked me to be here on their behalf. Another thing I want to make clear at the outset of my testimony is I don't want anyone to misinterpret any of my testimony or anything I say here today as in any way undermining or questioning the value of historic preservation. The historic preservation is obviously a very important thing. SHPO plays a very key role in that process. The point of this bill is not to undermine that role, but to hopefully make it more efficient and to bring some accountability to that process. excuse me, briefly, for those of you who are unfamiliar with what the Section 106 process is, it is part of the National Historic Preservation Act, and Section 106 requires that if there is a, quote, federal undertaking, the federal government or its designee must take into consideration what effect that federal undertaking may have on historic properties or properties that are eligible for historic preservation. A federal undertaking could be issuance of a license, like from the Corps of Engineers, or it could just be the provision of federal funding. And this is often the case where federal funds are given to a state agency, and then the federal agency makes the state agency its designee, which means the state agency is then in charge of fulfilling the Section 106 rules. As part of that process, the federal government or its designee must work with consulting parties. And depending on the nature of the project, consulting parties can vary. If it's a property that has significance to tribal organizations, the tribes will be consulting parties. But one constant in that is SHPO. SHPO is always a consulting party for any federal 106 process. So SHPO is always involved whenever there's a Section 106 process here in Minnesota. SHPO is always involved. the experience I and my clients have had, and in speaking with other clients whom I have not represented in Section 106 processes but who have shared their experiences with me, is, again, it's not a frustration with the point of Section 106 or the need for historic preservation. It is frustration with the what feels to be the inefficiency and the slowness with which that process happens. And some examples of that. Under Section 106, there are some critical junctures where the consulting parties have 30 days to make a determination. So the federal entity will make a determination, for instance, as to whether the federal undertaking is going to have effects on historic properties, and then the consulting parties have 30 days under the 106 rules to either agree with the determination, to remain silent, which amounts to an agreement, or to oppose that or to disagree with that determination, in which case then more process is needed. So there are certain points within the Section 106 rules where 36 days are allowed for a decision. The challenges that we've encountered is that SHPO allows itself 30 days with regard to anything that is submitted before it or any decision that needs to be made, even when it's not at those mandatory critical junctures. This becomes so obviously you can imagine how that has exponential effects. Every time you send something where you're seeking input and hoping to make the process more efficient, now you have to build an additional 30 days into the process. And if they come back with comments, they want you to fix something and you have to resubmit, that's another 30 days. And this obviously lengthens the process, and this has become critical, particularly where this is a project that is getting federal funding. If a process takes too long, there's the possibility that the very funding that puts you into the Section 106 process could get lost because of the length of the time it's taken. Also, as I don't need to tell anybody here, we have a very limited construction season here in Minnesota. So it only takes the addition of a couple of months to a process to take one out of an entire year's construction season and to back a project off into another season, which again can put funding and other things at risk. Another challenge that we've run into is, just as Representative Eklund alluded to, is its ability to partner with these federal entities and their partners. My most recent experience with this, it was a state agency who, again, I will not name, but this was their first time through the Section 106 process. And by their own admission, there was a learning curve for them. So they, you know, were seeking help and guidance from SHPO, which, in fairness, SHPO did provide at various points, but it gets back to the timing. Asking SHPO for assistance in this instance would lengthen the process. There were also, you know, other instances where they were less helpful. They would take more of a hands-off role, and so then the agency would make a decision, and then SHPO would be critical of that. So partnering is a challenge. The point of this bill would be to put SHPO within the context of a full-on regulatory agency that has experience with these sorts of things and hopefully can provide some more guidance and oversight than is currently available or currently exists. And then lastly, the lack of accountability, which again Representative Eklund alluded to. Right now, again, there's people who are in the midst of this process feel a little stuck with the exactly who they can appeal to try to speed up the process. When you're in the middle of this process, frankly, you're walking a tight you're walking a tightrope between trying to speed up your process and trying to make your concerns known when the process seems to be taking longer than it needs to. But at the same time, you need SHPO to be on your side. Ultimately, you need them to agree with the determinations that you're making. So you're walking that fine line between trying to make them accountable and risking angering or alienating them and risking a negative determination on something you're putting before them and further lengthening the process. The hope with this bill is by putting them within the rubric of the Department of Administration, again, there's more accountability. There is a system. This is a regulatory process, so to those of us who support this bill, it only makes sense that this very important regulatory process be within the context of a regulatory agency. So in conclusion, I just want to reiterate, none of us, at least myself, and I think I speak for all who support this bill, we're not saying that there aren't very important things that SHPO needs to consider, and no one is asking SHPO to cut corners with its regulatory oversight role. We are just asking that by placing it within the responsibility of the Department of Administration, hopefully that process can be made more efficient.
Mr. Hefner, thank you for your testimony. Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Eklund. We, from what I see in how the bill is written, and it has to be under Statute 15.039, it looks like you're simply going to have more of the same, but under a different roof. So how can you guarantee that with this move that we will have more accountability and the things that we're efficiency and the things that we're looking for to correct the problems under SHPO?
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, thanks for the question. I think what will happen here for accountability and moving things faster is we're going to move it into the 21st century. Right now, SHPO is real slow with paperwork. They're not up to speed with the technology issues. And as you know, I'm a paper guy. I always tell you to make as many copies as possible. But I'm also an electronics guy, so if I get it something electronically and I need a copy, then I can get it. And that function isn't happening in the SHPO office right now.
Representative Fenton, follow.
No, that's enough. Thank you.
Representative Szczynski, followed by Representative Joachim.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to thank Representative Eklund for moving this bill forward. Just a question for the testifier. just in general, you kind of talked a little bit about, during your testimony, kind of that the time, but also wanting to push, but kind of that, like, is there personalities involved in this, or is this, do you feel like, you know, when you're moving something forward, do you feel like there's some real guardrails as something moves forward that, you know, no matter what would happen, that you at least feel like you're getting a fair shake? Or do you feel like, you know, what would be, you know, from a management standpoint, do you think, I mean, personalities are involved in this? You know, if you're the wrong person at the wrong place at the wrong time, it, you know, one person might be able to get something through, but another person may not? Or
Mr. Hefner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I I'm not going to claim that the frustrations we had were particular to any person. The frustrations we had really seemed to be systemic to the process. You know, again, for instance, this policy that SHPO seems to have to give itself 30 days, regardless of the the degree of seriousness of the submission, that even routine submissions can take up to 30 days to get a response. So I believe it. I'm not going to discount the possibility that there may be personalities involved, but I really believe it is more of a systemic issue.
Okay. Representative Susinski, follow up. Representative Joaquin, followed by Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't think I could have said it any better than what Representative said. Same problems, just different roof. But I guess, Representative Eklund, I am concerned that we, instead of addressing the problem and trying to figure out how to work it out under the Historical Society and SHPO, that we're just picking it up and moving the problem somewhere else. I'm not quite understand about the electronic issue that you mentioned, but that same electronic issue is going to be in the Department of Admin that they're going to have to take care of as well. Are you aware of the cuts to the Department of Admin that we're making in the state government finance bill?
Representative Eklund.
Mr. Chair, Representative Noel, I am somewhat aware of that, but I don't sit on that committee, so obviously we'll have to talk about it amongst our group. But we've been working on this issue for a few months, and things weren't getting straightened up, so that's when it became clear that we needed to maybe have some legislation to try to address it. So that's the reason we're bringing this bill forward now.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's good that you're working on it. I think around here a few months isn't a lot of time to then move a whole entire agency. Maybe this question's to Mr. Hefner. You mentioned the 30-day clock. Did you foresee that changing at all? I mean, I'm not as familiar with Sections 106 where the Historic Preservation Act in the 70s was developed, but they're just following the rules that are there. So are you saying the Department of Admin will, like, wink, wink, nod, nod, and not look at those rules then, or?
Mr. Hefner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the point of the 30-day is that there are a few points in the Section 106 process that mandate that consulting parties have a 30-day. My point is that even regardless of the submission to SHPO, even if it's routine, even if it's not at those critical junctures, they allow themselves 30 days, sometimes more, to provide a response. So it is not just those critical junctures that under the rules consulting parties are allowed a full 30 days. It is everything that is submitted to SHPO, even non-routine, even things that you discuss these with SHPO to say, this is the direction we're going to go, this is the submission we're going to find. You submit it, and the response back is, okay, we'll get back to you within 30 days. So it is those routine things, the things that frankly shouldn't take 30 days to get a response, that the hope is by putting them, again, within the rubric of a regulatory agency and to make, to hopefully bring some pressure and the experience that a regulatory agency has on these sorts of things to bring that pressure to bear to make that, make those routine submissions, responses to those more efficient.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more thing, I guess, more of a concern than a question. I was made aware of this bill actually the day it was introduced by a constituent who's an architect that works with historic preservation, and he was very, very concerned that we'd be moving something like this out of the purview of the Historical Society, where people have the expertise to look at these buildings, into an administration that may not and does not have the expertise to look over these historic preservation issues. And so I dug into it a little bit more. And I am really concerned that expertise won't be there. They don't have the database or the electronic stuff that you're worried about yet either at the Department of Admin. There's going to be some time to get all that up and running. There's federal fundings tied together that have to have state matches. The Historical Society has a little bit more money for that. We're moving this into an agency that is receiving tremendous cuts from the state government finance bill. And I don't serve on the finance part of the committee either, but I've been following it, and I just don't see how they're going to be capable of taking that over. But maybe I'll just wait and hear what some of the other testifiers have to say. Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess, Mr. Hefner, I guess the question I have for you, what kind of projects are we talking about here? It kind of perked my ears up when you said we keep talking about this limited construction season, and as a former carpenter, retired carpenter, I remember one February, I think it was Lincoln's birthday, it was 20 below, and we busted open the ground and put footings in for a project. So I know I've worked year-round in the trades. I know road construction sometimes can be limited. So what kind of projects are we talking about here, and are there any specific projects that have been held up because of this that maybe couldn't go forward?
Mr. Hefner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the sorts of things, when I say federally funded projects, I'm talking about pretty massive infrastructure projects, you know, wastewater treatment systems, roads, as you alluded to. So not only is the construction season limited, the people who can do that work are, you know, in high demand. So if there's two competing projects and one is federally funded and one is awaiting funding, it's obviously the contractor is going to go with the project that is fully funded. So when I talk about the construction season, I'm talking about some, you know, pretty significant local infrastructure projects that receive federal funding.
Representative Nelson, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, okay, I said, it sounds like there's something going on here beyond just what's been talked about here and personalities. I guess another question I have, and maybe that's for you, Mr. Chair, do we have testifiers coming down from the Historical Society to give maybe the other side of this? And
Representative Nelson, we actually have three testifiers plus public testimony to go through today, and Representative Eklund still has another person from the Department of Administration that he's identified that he wants to have testify on his behalf, and we still have some other member questions. So this is an informational hearing. I certainly want to give it as vetting, but the major item before us, I want to make sure we have enough time to deal with today as well. And we do have session today. And I was kidding, maybe, when I said this morning, for those of you who are here, that we may be coming back tonight. And the pace that we're on, we may be coming back tonight. So,
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to make sure we get all the stories.
Absolutely. Yep.
Not take all our time up on.
Absolutely. Yep. I agree, Representative Nelson. Representative Nash is the last member I have for Mr. Hefner right now. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Eklund, currently who is SHPO accountable to?
Representative Eklund?
I believe they would be accountable to the Historical Society, Mr. Keller, and that's where they work out of. And I would assume that they have to answer to the Department of Administration, but I guess I really don't know. Full answer to that question, Representative.
Representative Nelson, follow up. Representative Nash.
You get us confused so often. We're so similar. Mr. Hefner, would you like to maybe answer that question currently?
Mr. Hefner?
Because as my understanding, they're not accountable currently. But if I just like to know.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I actually don't know that they're accountable to the Department of Administration. I think the members of the Historical Society can speak to this themselves, but I believe the buck essentially stops at the Historical Society. I don't know what accountability there is above the Historical Society.
Okay. Representative Nash, follow-up.
Mr. Chair, maybe we can just have some of the other testifiers maybe fill in the blanks, or perhaps staff could help us out there.
Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, so the Historical Society is sort of its own sort of quasi state agency type of entity that's subject to administration by its own board, so there's no direct accountability to the Department of Administration or other state agencies within the society itself.
Very good. Representative Eklund, you said you had someone from the Department of Administration. Would that be Mr. Scheer? Or is there, yes, then let's bring Mr. Scheer up at this point, since it is one of the people that Representative Eklund. Mr. Hefner, thank you for your time this morning. Mr. Chair, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to provide some testimony and information regarding House File 2366. As the previous testifiers indicated and the author indicated, 2366 proposes the transfer of SHPO from the Historical Society to admin. I am here today to help describe a little bit of the transfer authority. First of all, Governor Dayton does recommend this transfer of the historic preservation duties to the Department of Admin in his supplemental budget. And as the previous testifiers also provided a little information about the history of SHPO. SHPO was established in 1969 in response to the National Historic Preservation Act of 1966. And each state does have a SHPO that is delegated authority from the federal government to implement state historic preservation plan, evaluate rehabilitation projects that qualify for federal assistance, and to assist federal, state agencies, and tribal governments with carrying out historic preservation activities. Minnesota SHPO serves the dual purpose of ensuring the compliance with federal and state historic preservation law and plays a key role in the administration of federal and state historic preservation tax credits. The proposed transfer in front of you guys, the members today, would involve a number of moving parts. Admin has been working with the Historical Society staff and researching SHPO operations in other states to understand better SHPO functions, to assess the practicality, budgetary, and functional impacts of the proposed transfer, to identify how SHPO responsibilities are organized in other states, and to develop a transition plan for transferring SHPO and staff as seamlessly as possible if this legislation passes. Mr. Chair and committee members, the proposed transfer and transition plan will require both statutory and budgetary changes, and we are still in the process of fleshing out specifics, and we are working on finalizing cost estimates. What we know now is that we anticipate that most of the funding would come from a transfer of base funding and federal grant funds from the Historical Society to admin. But in completing the transfer, we also would require some one-time funding to physically relocate operations. And as the previous testifier indicated, it will involve some IT resources to begin to address some IT needs and transfer the 19 SHPO databases to admin. Keep in mind that because Historical Society is not a state agency, its databases and IT support are not currently on the state IT system. Mr. Chair and committee members, it is also our understanding that some of the relative software licensing is set to expire in October and that all SHPO work occurs in a paper-based record system so that IT support is essential to improving the SHPO functions going forward. Overall, a smooth transfer of SHPO functions will involve moving approximately 20 non-state employees into state service. With regard to bill language, we think that House File 2366 would need to be amended to include references to admin's transfer authority under 16B37 and to amend Minnesota Statutes 290.0618, which is the Historic Structure Rehabilitation Tax Credit, to reference admin instead of Minnesota Historical Society. Mr. Chair and committee members, for background, House File 2366, if 2366, excuse me, is enacted, Minnesota would not be the only state that would have assigned SHPO responsibilities to a cabinet agency. SHPO is situated within an executive branch agency in 48 of 50 states, and only in Minnesota and Ohio is SHPO located outside of a state agency. Our review of other states indicate that 18 states, or about one-third of states, SHPO is situated within a state agency that within state agencies that do not have primary responsibilities for broader historic preservation functions. A couple examples of that, Mr. Chair and committee members. In Michigan, SHPO is in the Housing Development Authority as part of the equivalent of their deed. A number of other states, including New York, Arizona, Alaska, Georgia, Oregon, Tennessee, SHPO is in the Natural Resources, Environment, and State Parks Department. And in Washington State, SHPO and the Office of the State Archaeologist are in a 23-person independent state agency and commission located within the executive branch. As is the case in the Washington State example, the alignment of SHPO's function with the duties of the state archaeologist The alignment of SHPO's functions with the duties of the state archaeologist in the Department of Administration. 35 states have the functions within the same agency due to their complementary functions. The Office of the State Archaeologist was transferred from Minnesota Historical Society to admin in 1997. And similar to SHPO, the archaeologist has a compliance function related to development projects and works closely with the Minnesota Historical Society, the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, MnDOT, DNR, and local governments and other partners to fulfill its responsibilities. We found that SHPO offices are similarly aligned with the complementary state archaeologist functions in 35 other states. As this proposal moves forward, the department will continue to work with the author as well as the appropriate finance chairs to finalize fiscal impacts, And language revisions necessary to ensure that the potential transfer does indeed serve preservation and customer needs. And I'm happy to stand for any questions if there are any member questions.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Nash, and that looks like Representative Joaquin next. And again, members, if I just want to ask a question here. We have session at 10. Do you want us to schedule for later tonight? Or, I mean, we're happy to have the conversation. Remember, informational only on this, and it's an important topic. Are we going to get done by 10? I want to cater to you. Okay. Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, I'll be brief. Mr. Chair, did you say 19 databases? Because that's a lot. And then if you could detail the software issues, please.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, 19 databases, I think, is what has been indicated to admin by the Historical Society. So understanding what those are would be probably a question better directed to the Historical Society. The software issues that I think I've been made aware of through conversations that our staff have had with Historical Society staff is that some of those databases may be in Microsoft Access, which I think is no longer going to be supported by the Microsoft company in the future.
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, information only. I'll deal with this later.
Okay. Representative Joaquin, followed by Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a real quick question, Mr. Chair. Did you say 20 employees will have to transfer? I missed that.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Joaquin, 20, I think, is the number that we have worked with the Historical Society to determine those employees that do the duties inside of their agency with respect to SHPL.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to make some comments, then the people at the desk can choose to comment on that. I have some real problems with this, and first of all, I think MHS has a real strong base in this state, and it's older than the state, so I really do trust the Historical Society. I also have a problem with the gentleman that was saying he wants to get it done quicker because of construction, and again, having sat on a city council, it's really difficult sometimes to get things done in a timely manner and still get all the information that you need. So I guess that's not a strong argument for me. And then the other thing is the way that EQB has been treated. I mean, that should be a major state entity, and it's been transferred out of the Department of Administration to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I believe that's a backwards way of dealing with the EQB. So, as I said, I just have real problems with this at this time.
Mr. Scherer or Representative Eklund, Representative Mason asked if either of you wanted to comment on that. Did either of you want to take up the question or the statement? Representative Eklund.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and I understand your concerns and duly noted. Thank you, Representative.
Okay. Mr. Scherer, thank you. Mr. Elliott, followed by Ms. Berg, and then if there's anyone else who's interested in testifying on the matter before the committee, we'll get you in queue here as well. Mr. Elliott, good morning. Welcome, Mr. Elliott, to the committee, and if you'd state your name for the record, proceed with your testimony. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Stephen Elliott. I'm the director and CEO of the Minnesota Historical Society. And I thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to comment on this bill. And I know you all are pressed for time, but I hope you will bear with me because there's been more than a half an hour of comment, and I have a few minutes of things I'd like to share with you. Not surprisingly, we believe that the proper place for the State Historic Preservation Office is the Minnesota Historical Society. After the passage of the National Historic Preservation Act of 1966, the State Historic Preservation Office was placed by statute in the Minnesota Historical Society, and this has worked well for nearly 50 years. What has made this successful is the ability of the office to coordinate and collaborate with professional staff doing similar work, both within the Heritage Preservation Department, which also administers grants and provides field service support, both of them all across the state, and with a staff that includes historians, historical architects, archaeologists, and other experts doing other work. as well as within the larger Minnesota Historical Society, where we carry out a wide range of history-related services. Let me take a moment to tell you what the State Historic Preservation Office does. Nationally, historic preservation is a state-federal partnership resulting from the National Historic Preservation Act of 1966. This act sets out the responsibility of state and federal agencies in regard to historic preservation, and that's more than just 106 reviews, which is what we've been focusing on. The duties are many: surveying historic resources, coordinating the National Register of Historic Places, administering historic preservation tax credits, working with many stakeholders, including many units of government, and consulting with federal agencies when historic resources may be affected. This latter activity, historic preservation reviews, probably receives the most attention. It certainly has here this morning. In the area of reviews, the main responsibilities are with federal agencies. They're the drivers. The State Historic Preservation Office responds, reviews, and comments on decisions that are made by the federal agencies. It's a consulting role. In the single area of historic preservation reviews, the State Historic Preservation Office processes thousands of reviews each year in that one area of work, over 3,000 in the most recent fiscal year. The vast majority of these reviews results in findings of no effect on historic resources. In a small number of cases, less than 1%, federal agencies working in collaboration with the State Historic Preservation Office and other stakeholders determine the best way to avoid, minimize, or mitigate a negative effect on historic resources. Again, this process in which the State Historic Preservation Office plays a reviewing, commenting, and consulting role is guided by federal law. As we do this work, we frequently answer questions about the historic preservation review process and troubleshoot as necessary. We have done this many times over the years, often communicating with your colleagues who have questions about the process. We don't simply respond. We also advise and help. A few words about accountability. This is a federally driven process in which we have a role, as I've described, but ultimately, accountability rests primarily with the federal agencies and the executive branch of the federal government. A federal agency, the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation, coordinates and arbitrates differences in historic preservation reviews between the participants. At the state level, the Minnesota Historical Society carries out its state historic preservation responsibilities as outlined in statute. We are accountable to you, the legislature, which develops statutes and appropriates funds. That's why I'm here this morning. And to the governor, who must approve them, and who is an ex officio member of our governing board, the Executive Council. We feel this accountability keenly. We work to lead in our field, to be responsive to your and the executive branch's interests, and to communicate with you about our wide-ranging work. We have, over the years, answered many inquiries from you and your colleagues in the legislature when questions have arisen over reviews in your areas, and they've always been resolved. And over the years, the Minnesota State Historic Preservation Office has successfully reviewed many, many complex and costly projects, big infrastructure projects, you heard, including transportation projects, electric transmission projects, pipeline projects, and dozens of historic tax projects, historic preservation tax credit projects. Now, have we always performed perfectly? Well, of course not. While this heavy a workflow with sometimes complicated situations that require professional judgments in gray areas, with a process that people really don't want to participate in, but, you know, they're required to, and with many, many stakeholders involved, there's opportunity for disagreement and for error. If there are a small number of reviews that cause concern, we work together to resolve those issues. We have service to Minnesota in our DNA, and we're committed to listening to feedback and working continuously to improve how we do the work that we do. I hope your decision about this bill will rest on where this important work of historic preservation advising can be done most effectively and most efficiently. And there is no doubt in my mind that's best accomplished in the Minnesota Historical Society, which has the track record, long track record, expertise to do this work well at the least cost. Transferring this function will not only be more costly, which I'll come back to in a minute, it will disrupt the work, and this will happen at a time when uncertainty at the federal level may already complicate the process for stakeholders, and when we are on the threshold of chinning up to major technological improvements in the application process and in digitizing nearly a half century of working files. I think those major projects can best be addressed by those who have had the experience in dealing with the need for those projects and looking at how they can be done. So let me address a couple of the points that have been raised, and then I'll close. There's been reference to where this is placed in other agencies, and I think it's important to note that in many states it is placed in the state historical society, and by noting that in 18 states it's in areas that don't have an affinity with the work, in 32 states it is. And I think we should be careful what we wish for if we want to bring ourselves to the level of other states, because Minnesota prides itself on having the most comprehensive, best practice, strongest, largest membership historical society in the country. And it's because of the model in Minnesota. We were chartered by one of the first acts of the first territorial legislature. We have grown up with Minnesota. As history-related services needed to be done, they were placed under one umbrella, which I think it's a good thing happens to be a 501c3. That's been good, because over the last 15 years, our state funding and actual dollars has declined by 20%, and our workload has not. We have worked to bring in other funding to keep that work going. There is no way this can be a revenue-neutral transfer. And if you'd like to provide more resources to do the work which we've asked for, and which we will be asking for to tackle the digitization issues, please fund it in the Minnesota Historical Society. I would, I have to say, and I think you could identify with this, there's been a lot of generalization, you know, broad brush references to dissatisfaction here and there, and but no names and no specific references, and the gentleman that spoke here has not addressed any of those concerns with me. That's the first step toward improvement. You know, anybody needs that feedback to improve the process that comes underway. And this bill coming up, several folks referenced to me that this was being brought by the Chamber of Commerce, and I called the CEO of the Chamber of Commerce, and he said, no, this is not on our screen. Quote, there's nothing to that. This is not on the Chamber's agenda. So I think there's a bit of a smoke screen here, and I think that's not a helpful way to tackle issues. I just refer back to the fact that this is federal law. There is a prescribed process, as was mentioned. There are issues systemic to the process. There are these 30-day responses. We don't always take, you would get the impression, we always take, no. We try to respond as quickly as we can, and we try to be helpful. Let me give you an example. I had heard that there had been one project that had been difficult. So I went to the COO of that organization and said, tell me about your experience. And he said, well, it was difficult, but it wasn't the State Historic Preservation Office's problem. The architect that we hired did not take the time to familiarize himself with how the work needed to be done. And when we got there, there was a lot of that had to be revisited. Your staff was very helpful in helping us get through that. I know in a recent major project, and I think this may be the one Representative Eklund mentioned, that involves big project, involves several federal agencies. They're the ones that control the schedule who's going to be on the phone calls, when the material gets out. There were times when we got the material the day before, the day of a call. We tried to deal with it. We tried to turn it around promptly. Yet, you know, we're the closest place where a finger can be pointed. And transferring to this to the Department of Administration is not going to shorten, it's not going to change the prescribed federal process, and it's not going to guarantee that just because, I hope this wouldn't be the case, somebody can pull a string, that it's going to change the work based on meritorious judgment of how these processes proceed. So I come before you because I feel that I can defend the work that we have done and the work that this this lean staff that is able to also draw on the expertise of others can do in getting this work done. And I hope that we will have the privilege of continuing to serve the people of Minnesota by providing this service, and I appreciate the opportunity to address it with you this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Elliott, for your testimony. Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I realize this is an informational hearing, and we have other business we got to get worked on, too, but Mr. Elliott, we've heard there's issues. We've heard there have been problems on different projects. We've heard there's been, I've heard outside of this committee, there's been issues where the governor's had to step in and mediate some of this stuff. I've also heard that in some cases where the governor's office has been told to mind your own business, or we're not going to change our methods. And sometimes when things don't get worked out, the only recourse we have as a state representative is to put a bill in. And I don't know if that's what this bill is here, is to do get a message, a shot across the ball, so to speak. But I guess the question is, can we fix these problems? It sounds like there's certain issues that have been ongoing with, can these problems be fixed so that, this isn't the solution then, that with the solution is comes from within and not have to come from without?
Mr. Elliott, I don't know if you want to respond to that.
Thank you. Yes, I would like to. Thank you. I think first we need to see whatever problems are being raised in the context of all the work that is done by this unit and the fact that this is a regulatory process that people don't enjoy, and it's a process that is prescribed by federal law. And where we can do better, we are eager to do better, but that requires somebody telling us when we fall short, and so that we have that feedback and we can look at how we can improve our work. I'm not familiar with what you're talking about. On rare occasion, the governor's office has asked if we are responding as promptly as we can, and we have responded. And again, any time that we fall short, we want to learn from that how we can do better. We could always use more staff. The workload has increased. The funding has gone down. We do need to invest in modernizing the work of the department technologically and in digitizing the files. And those are two projects that will require resources wherever they are. They can be done with us, with the resources. I think we have a better handle on what needs to be done because we've been dealing with it and planning it.
Representative Nelson, follow up.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. We have made numerous cuts in the state government also over the last 15 years or so that we have staff working, doing a lot more work with less staff. I think there's a problem here, and I think we're kind of dancing around it. I'm not sure what it exactly is, but I think as we move forward this bill, we should probably, and because I know it's just informational, we're not going to be taking a vote today, but we need to make sure that the problems get worked out, because I think it sounds like there's merit on both sides of what's going on here. There's got to be some sort of solution that we can fix this, and hopefully this bill will be the shot across the ball to get both sides to come together and work on the problem and move it forward.
Representative Hellerson, followed by Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And briefly, I know that we've got a very full agenda today, but in the event that this ends up in an omnibus bill without us getting to vote on it, I want to be sure we get to ask our questions. And so, Mr. Elliott, my question to you, I've heard a lot of testimony with regard to the hope for this bill, that they hope that it will create more efficiency. They hope that it will streamline the process. But my question to Mr. Elliott is, will they need to continue to engage the Historical Society with regard to finding the expertise? Because I assume that the expertise on historic preservation in Minnesota does not reside within the Department of Administration. So will the Historical Society need to be tapped in the event that this responsibility does get moved?
Well, Representative Halverson, before you go to Mr. Elliott, lines 2.13 through 2.17, I think, begin to answer your question. But Mr. Elliott.
If it moves, we will, of course, be as helpful as we can, not only during the transition, but afterwards. And, for example, the Office of the State Archaeologist was referenced, which is, I think, two FTEs. That's actually physically housed in our offices. And, we would be available, but I don't think it would work nearly as smoothly as it does now, where the State Historic Preservation Office is one of three functions embedded in a larger department where there's staff, literally sitting next to each other, where they can consult, and where there is one shared director. This is about as efficient as it's going to get. This is going to cost a lot more if it transfers.
Thank you.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I that was a lot of the questions I was going to ask. I was going to maybe quickly detail. I had heard you say, and I just want to confirm, you said a lot of the timetables on this process are actually run by the feds?
Yes. The process is prescribed by the feds.
So that's my concern, that process and the timetable where people are going to have isn't going to change by just moving it to a different department. When we talk about people working in a collaborative environment and relying on each other's expertise, how many folks do you have do just this work, or do they do other work, and how do you untangle that?
Mr. Elliott.
Thank you, sir. That will be a challenge. This sits in the Heritage Preservation Department. It's one of three units in that department, which includes the Grants Administration and Field Services. So the funding for State Historic Preservation, there are pieces of people that are allocated to that. So teasing that out is one of the challenges that we've had with admin and MMB in looking at this transition. So there are actually there's a lot of staff expertise, pieces of which move into this.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you.
All right. Are there other questions for Mr. Elliott? Seeing none, thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
And Ms. Berg. And again, if there's anyone else who'd like to testify on the matter before the committee, please identify yourself to the page and we'll get you in. Ms. Berg, good morning and welcome. If you'll identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair and members. My name is Erin Hannafin-Berg. I'm the Director of Policy and Services for the Preservation Alliance of Minnesota. The Preservation Alliance of Minnesota is a nonprofit organization with a mission to connect people to historic places, promoting community vitality. Since our founding in 1981, we've represented and supported a wide variety of stakeholders in their efforts to save, revitalize, and honor the places that matter to them. Our members include individuals, communities, municipalities, other nonprofit organizations, developers, design professionals, and contractors. The Preservation Alliance often serves as a consulting party on the kinds of projects that have been referenced this morning. We acknowledge and recognize that there is room for improvement in the operations of the State Historic Preservation Office because we hear about the frustrations from our own members, and we've had our own challenges in working with the SHPO in the course of our work. But we encourage the state to engage a wide variety of stakeholders in an intentional and transparent process that would identify the best place to house the SHPO, whether it's at the Minnesota Historical Society or at another agency. And that we will, and that we hope that process would lead to a refinement of the programs and the policies that are in place to protect Minnesota's irreplaceable historic and cultural resources. That's all the statement I have this morning, but I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Ms. Berg. Questions for Ms. Berg this morning, members? Seeing none, thank you for being with us this morning. Is there anyone else in the public who'd like to speak on the matter before the committee this morning? Seeing none, hearing none. Other member questions? Seeing none, hearing none. Representative Eklund, thank you. And again, this is an informational hearing, so there will be no action on House File 2366. But we'll give you the final word this morning, Representative Eklund.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. And I thank you for the time on hearing this bill, and let's see if we can try to make this process work better, however it may come along. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. We will now proceed to interviewing candidates for the Campaign Finance Board. And the first person I will have come forward is Ms. Peggy Lebeck. Good morning, Ms. Lebeck. Welcome to the committee. I know you're no stranger to being in front of this committee as someone who's currently serving on the Campaign Finance Board. And if you'd like to start with some comments and introduce yourself as a candidate to the committee, and then as you see, the committee is not shy about asking questions. So, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate this opportunity to come before you and introduce myself. My name is Peggy Lebeck, and I do serve currently on the Campaign.
Ms. Lebeck, if you could just pull the microphone just a little bit closer for
sure.
There we go. Thank you.
How's that? I'll slide over a little too. I've been a very active volunteer for many years because it's a great way to get involved and to help people and make friends all at the same time. It's how I give back to my adopted community of over 40 years. My volunteer activities are also what eventually led me to run for the House of Representatives in 1990, where I served for 12 years, including chair as chair of the Higher Education Finance Committee. Shortly after I retired from the House in January of 2003, Governor Pawlenty appointed me to the Metropolitan Council, where I served for 8 years, the last three as vice chair. After leaving the Metropolitan Council, I remain interested in public affairs, but I have not been particularly active in the political arena. I have served on the Campaign Finance Board since my appointment in May 2015 and would like to continue because I believe strongly in the importance of the work that it does. The agency's charged to oversee and publish information about money raised and spent to influence state elections is vital to the integrity of our elections and the public's trust in the decisions that are made in state government. I have a few thoughts about the Campaign Finance Board itself that I would like to share with you. Because the board is a quasi-judicial agency, most important is the absolute necessity of fairness and consistency, regardless of one's political affiliation, when dealing with individual cases. The fact that the board must be politically balanced helps engender confidence in the decisions that the board makes on the cases that come before it and the impartiality. I also like that it has representation by people who have run for state office because they know what it's like to be directly influenced by the state campaign finance laws, which can be really complicated and not always crystal clear. The board expects a great deal from candidates and their treasurers, who are nearly always volunteers, and so it has a responsibility to provide good training and readily available help when it's needed. Much of this work is done by an excellent staff, and people tell us that overall the board does a very good job. It has been my privilege to serve on the board for almost 2 years. I hope that I have made a positive contribution in this time and have lived up to my own expectations of bringing a nonpartisan and open-minded approach to each case that has come before the board. I would be honored to continue for a full term. Thank you, and I look forward to your questions.
Ms. Lebeck, thank you. Members, questions for Ms. Lebeck? Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just thought I should mention, primarily for the benefit of my colleagues on my side of the aisle, Former Representative Lepick, or board member Lepick, whatever title I should use, was my representative for a decade or so. And, you know, we certainly weren't in the same party to agree on everything, but I think she's a really strong candidate. You know, I think she should continue in this role. She's done a good job. She serves with integrity. So hope everyone will consider her and approve her here, and I hope that we give the board the tools and resources it needs to effectively monitor our activities here, too.
Other member questions for Ms. Lepick? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll use this one. I was just wondering, what's your interpretation of the scope of the board's rulemaking authority?
Ms. Lepick.
My interpretation of the scope, Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, I'm not quite sure what you mean.
Representative Peterson, do you want to rephrase the question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I mean, should the Campaign Finance Board use rulemaking to implement new policy?
Ms. Lepick.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, I think if you don't mind, I've given this a great deal of thought, and actually I'm really glad that you asked the question. I'm going to come at the answer just slightly differently because I think this is really what you're getting at, and that is, should the rulemaking authority go back to the legislature and be removed from the Campaign Finance Board? Am I correct in that?
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I mean, you know, how far should the rulemaking go, I guess, is kind of what we're sort of trying to get our arms around. Should the rulemaking be kind of like law changes, or do you think that the, you know, how far should the rulemaking go is what we're trying to get our arms around.
Okay, Representative Mr. Chair. Rulemaking actually becomes statute. It's not really rulemaking. If it is done by the legislature, it goes into the statutes. They aren't rules anymore. And as I said, I've given a lot of thought to this. In fact, I wrote down some notes just to keep my own thoughts straight. And if you don't mind, I will go through that.
Sure.
And frankly, I don't think that it's a good idea to take the rulemaking authority away from the board for a number of reasons. And Jeff Sigurdsson, our executive director, has already testified on two of those reasons. The first one is that rulemaking gives us the ability to give consistent answers on how to comply with the provisions of Chapter 10A. And secondly, we have the availability of staff expertise, which has been developed over the years, and this was an issue that came up in the previous case that was before you, your testimony. I have another reason that comes down to public trust. I believe the office of the original law that enacted the Campaign Finance Board gave it rulemaking authority because the rules directly affect legislators' own campaigns. And they wanted to remove any hint of conflict of interest in the rulemaking process. As it is now, public trust is high that the board decisions are impartial and based on rules that are reasonable and clear and fair. The board is where people go to get their campaign finance questions answered and issues resolved. Thus, it's usually the first place where inconsistencies or ambiguities or other problems with Chapter 10A or the existing rules come to light. We have an experienced and a highly skilled staff that can spot these problems and draft language to correct them in a timely way. Rulemaking is a complicated and a very time-consuming process. And we don't do it often, partly for that reason. But when we do, we have the means to do it very well, thanks to an exceptional staff that reaches out, listens, writes, expedites, and makes the whole thing seem almost easy. I can tell you this from firsthand experience because together with my colleague on the board, Bob Moylan, who is here this morning, I serve on the rulemaking committee for the current docket. Following a mandated process, over the last 3 months, we have done extensive outreach to the public with follow-up contacts with interested individuals, associations, nonprofits. We've held 3 public hearings. We've revised and re-revised the drafts many times, and we sent the modified language to Senator Kiffmeyer at her request. The feedback from all of these sources has been very helpful and taken into careful consideration as we have made revisions to the drafts. Rulemaking, as I said, is a very public and a time-consuming process. But it's the best way that we know of to create rules that engender public trust in the execution of the campaign finance laws.
Representative Peterson, follow-up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your answers. And absolutely, the Campaign Finance Board has been a wonderful resource for candidates. There's no question about it. But I'm just wondering, you know, should the Campaign Finance Board use rulemaking authority to create policies that maybe the legislature did not create or intend, or how far should rulemaking go?
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, you know, I think it's very difficult sometimes to draw a line between what is just a rule and what's a policy. A rule carries out the policy.
Yeah.
And when issues come before us, we have to make a decision. We have to do something. And I think that certainly I believe, and most if not all of the board, believes that policy belongs at the legislature. But when we are faced with a particular decision on a particular rule, it's hard to tell whether that's sliding into policy or that if it's simply making a decision about a rule that's ambiguous. It's difficult. And I think that's why it's really important for us to have back and forth conversations with legislators and with and to go through this rulemaking process periodically when we know that there are problems with a particular rule. But should that mean that the whole rulemaking process get removed from the board and moved to the legislature? No, I don't think so.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think anyone that is looking at the background of this candidate has to know that it's an extensive and impressive background that shows her expertise and commitment to good government. And I'm just going to focus on the League of Women Voters positions on that, and as a former member, I can tell you, given the positions that I know Peggy has held, it does show that she knows how to work in a nonpartisan background as well as showing the depth to which she does go to get the work accomplished. So I think it would be hard to find a more impressive candidate. So I definitely am voting yes.
Other member questions at this time? Ms. Lovick. Seeing none, Ms. Levick, thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee members.
And we'll then proceed to our second candidate. And my intentions were to allow each candidate about 5 minutes to introduce themselves here this morning and to table 25 minutes for the questions. So we are on track for that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee, for having this hearing.
Mr. Moylan, welcome.
My name is Bob Moylan, and I thought what I would do is just kind of run through the resume highlights quickly and then try to give you some indication as to why I'm here today and why I applied to be on the board, and then I welcome your questions. And I would like to respond to Ms. Peterson's question.
Representative Peterson's questions?
But let me start by telling you a little bit about my background. I grew up in Golden Valley, went to Golden Valley High School, went to Gustavus Adolphus College, graduated from there in 3 years cum laude. That was in 1973. Went then to Washington, D.C., and had the opportunity to work as a staff assistant for former Senator Hubert Humphrey, the late Hubert Humphrey, and then was offered a position with Senator Mondale's office, and I worked in that office during the time period from 1974 to 1977 while I was in law school. I also worked at the Department of Justice while I was in law school as a law clerk. I came back to Minnesota and I worked at the Attorney General's office where I spent 2 years, and then I was invited back to Washington, D.C. to work for Vice President Mondale. And I spent 1980 working in the Vice President's office as an assistant to the Chief of Staff. That is not number two in the office. That is the assistant to the Chief of Staff that did everything he did not want to do. So we were then asked to leave office when Ronald Reagan defeated Jimmy Carter in the fall of 1980, and I vacated that position, came back to Minnesota, and worked for 17 years for a law firm called Popham Hague as a litigator in the securities area. That law firm imploded in the mid-1990s, and for the next 12 years I spent my time at three different venues, one in solo practice, one at a firm called Zimmerman Reed, which is a plaintiff's class action firm, and the other one with a firm called Anthony Oslin and Bear. I decided I wanted to end my career in the public sector, so I applied to become the Director of Securities for the Department of Commerce and was given that position in 2011. I spent 3 years there. I think that, and then I left there in very early 2015, and since that time I've been writing, visiting presidential libraries, destroying plants I buy at Bachman's, doing a variety of different things with my life. But I've always been involved in some way with public service and public policy. So why did I apply to this position? And I think is a question that people would want to know the answer to, and that is simply this. In my formative years in Washington, D.C., I had the opportunity to work there at a time when the Congress was extraordinarily well-respected for its bipartisanship. So I had the opportunity to see not only Democrats at work, but great Republicans participating in a process. Howard Baker, Charles Percy, Jacob Javits, those were the people who were walking the hallways of Congress. And they were making good things happen. And since that time, somehow or another, our institutions, both federally and at a state level to a degree, have lost some of their allure in the public's eye. The approval ratings of our governmental institutions have gone down steadily over the last 15 years. The last poll I saw of this body was done by KSTP in about 2012 or 13, I want to say, And people's view was that they approved this body by about 17%. There were only four legislatures in the country at that time, according to a University of Missouri report, in which only four states in which the approval rating was in excess of 50% for their legislators. So we have, I view the Campaign Finance Board as presenting a little bit of an opportunity to be of some assistance in creating a level of transparency that will permit the voters to have increasing confidence in their institutions. And that's why I applied. Now, let me just say that I want to do two things. I want to address Representative Peterson's question, but I also want to mention one other thing about my view of the board, which is a little bit different than what Ms. Lepik said. And I want to be fully transparent in who I am and what I am, because I don't think you should apply to a board that emphasizes transparency if you're not transparent yourself. I view the board as being bipartisan, not nonpartisan. There's a difference. We have three Republicans and we have three Democrats. Now, I've had the opportunity to attend four meetings of that board, and I can tell you that in at least 95% of the instances, there has been unanimity in the actions taken by the board. And the board cannot act unless there are four people in agreement. So the board has its own self-policing function that avoids a level of partisanship in terms of the way it functions, which I think is a very good thing. But it is not a nonpartisan board. And I can't come before you and tell you I'm nonpartisan, because I'm not. I'm a Democrat who has been asked to serve in the Democratic seat on that board. But that does not mean I'm not fair. It just means I'm a Democrat. So, Ms. Peterson's question went to rulemaking. Let me just quickly give you my response to that. No, I don't believe that the board can go outside the legislative mission in terms of its rulemaking. I think its rulemaking is designed to implement the mission set by the legislature. And I can give you an example of how that occurs if you want, very, very quickly. The legislature passed a law, for example, that said if you're a public official and you're appearing in front of a state agency representing a client, you must disclose that to the board. Conflict of interest situation. Well, that's a nice, from my standpoint, but that's a fine law. But the problem was you didn't say what needed to be disclosed. So we came in with rulemaking years and years ago and said, well, tell us what agency you're appearing in front of, tell us what client you're representing, tell us when you appear. Not very complicated, but it implemented what the legislature wanted to have happen. So there are instances where that is, I think, the fundamental goal of rulemaking, is to implement the legislative mission. There's one other area in the statute which you've given rulemaking authority to the board, and that is when we get advisory opinion after advisory opinion, the same issues coming up, that we should have the right to consolidate those opinions into a rule. At any rate, that's a long introduction. I apologize if I've taken too much time. I'll be happy to take questions.
Mr. Moreland, since you did broach the question that Representative Peterson had addressed, I kind of just had said about 5 minutes and then about 25 minutes worth of questions, so I'll count that as maybe an unasked question, but I am going to go to the person who did ask that question since you referenced her first to see if she has any follow-ups on that. All right, I do have a couple of members on the list right now. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Moreland, thank you for being here this morning. I took some time to read your articles that you've published, and I'd say that you're an excellent writer, and you make your point quite clearly. My question
really was stemmed from something that this reminded me of. Back in my high school days, I played a lot of baseball, and I was a relief pitcher. I had a great fastball, and I came in to a tournament, and I was called to deliver about 3 innings of relief pitching. Turns out that right before the game, the scheduled umpire couldn't be there, so they just found another umpire that seemed to be wandering around, and they pressed them into service. And I try to be as honest as I can. My stuff was on that day. It was really good. I was throwing high heat, and I was hitting the spots, but I could not buy a strike from the umpire. Turns out, in retrospect, that we found out that he was a local ref, or he was a local ump, and he lived in the community that we were playing. And here's my question. In your article regarding your desire for increased gun safety, gun control, two things. Again, I think you're an excellent writer, but you put in quotes the constitutional right to keep and bear arms, and you seem to question, from my perspective, the Heller decision, and I think that that's going to provide some lack of impartiality as it might relate to a pro-Second Amendment legislator that might have a campaign finance question brought before the board. And secondly, you're quite critical of Chair Cornish in your article, who's a sitting legislator who is going to be running again probably in a couple of years or in a year and a half. And I just wonder about your ability, to go back to my umpire analogy, to assess a ball or a strike. And I myself, too, am a very outspoken pro-Second Amendment legislator. And if somebody were to provide to lodge a spurious complaint, and I wonder about your impartiality regarding that, because you yourself just said that you are not nonpartisan, you are partisan. So I wonder if something like that were to come before you, by your own assessment, just how much of a ball or strike, what's my strike zone going to look like with you, because I have grave concerns about that.
Mr. Moylan.
And Representative Nash, I appreciate the question, and I appreciate the fact that someone read my article, which is very flattering. Let me first just quickly deal with the article, because I think it's sort of interesting, and then I'll try to address your question directly. I'm not actively involved in any gun control organizations or groups or anything like that. I'm a spectator who has been watching this debate, and constantly I've seen the gun control advocates come before the legislature and meet resistance, and so I kind of was wondering why we shouldn't at least begin a dialogue with, and if you read the last paragraph of the article you'll know, with those who support Second Amendment rights, those who support gun control, and the insurance companies. And the only thing that article said was that the Department of Commerce maybe should hold a hearing, or a meeting, not a hearing, with those entities to see whether or not we could provide relief to gun owners who employ safety measures within their home. That was the only point of that article, was can we give gun owners a benefit, a discount on their home insurance policies if they keep their gun safely at home, like a good driver discount. So it wasn't really an anti-gun ownership article. It was quite the opposite, I think. But having you're asked the question, can I call balls and strikes fairly? I think I can. And I don't think there's, I really don't think there's an issue there. First of all, if any one problem came before the board, if Representative Cornish had an issue or something, I would certainly recuse myself instantly if there was a problem. But I don't think there would be a problem. But no matter how much I tell you I could be fair, that probably will not satisfy you, because what, you know. So let me suggest something else. Let me suggest something to my Democratic colleagues, too, Alice. I had the opportunity when I was working at Pom Hake to work with a number of people who were very active in the Republican Party. And I've also worked with Democrats throughout my life. So If you want to know whether or not I'm a decent person or a fair person or an honest person, you're free to talk to those people. So I would welcome you to call Vice President Mondale if you want, or Mike Freeman, who I know quite well. On your side of the aisle, I had the opportunity to work with Wayne Popham, who was a former state Republican state legislator, Bruce Willis, who became a who was the legal counsel to the Republican Party, who became a Court of Appeals judge. I had the opportunity to work with Dave Doty, who was appointed by Ronald Reagan to the federal bench. And I had the opportunity to work, one of my peers was a guy named Doug Seaton, who's been very active recently in the Republican Party and the Freedom Club. You're free to talk to any of those people if you have doubts or questions about whether or not I can be fair.
Representative Nash, follow-up.
Mr. Chair, given the brevity that we need, I'll just pass.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll keep this short given the brevity. I don't actually know Mr. Moylan as well as former Representative Lepick. I do know he comes from a solid Golden Valley family. The first time I ran for city council in 2003, I actually met your mom while I was door knocking. So, generally that's good enough. You know, that's good enough for me. But obviously in addition to that, I think your qualifications are sterling. It's hard to argue with anything on your, you know, I think we have an opportunity to have a former high-level, you know, vice presidential staffer on the campaign finance board. I think that's great. And, I think it was, you know, this, as Mr. Moylan said, this is a bipartisan commission. There are three Democratic spots and three Republican spots. As I mentioned, I didn't always agree with everything former Representative Lepick did, but I certainly don't see the relevance of, you know, non-campaign finance issues like gun control to this position. This is a campaign finance board position. I think Mr. Moylan's legal qualifications make him eminently qualified to do that in a dispassionate manner, and I think we should support him as well.
Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mullen, and I've also read your articles, and I went out and did read a few more that were online. And frankly, they scare me if you want to sit on this board. You know, your resume is impressive. You are qualified to sit on this board through your resume. My problem comes with the prism in which you view politics, and you're quite vocal on those views of yours. And in my opinion, it's almost that you border on an activist, and not necessarily a street activist, but a very vocal, written, published activist. And the lack of respect that you show our sitting president and other legislators that you disagree with, frankly, gives me grave concern for your position on this board. You said that you would not, that you're not fair, or that you would be fair. Frankly, from what I read, I find that hard to believe that's possible, just the spectrum in which you view things. Yes, it is a bipartisan board, but the hyper-partisan which you express yourself through your articles, again, just gives me grand concern. And I really, that's just a comment, it's not a question, so... if you want to comment, you're welcome to. Thank you.
Mr. Moylan, although there wasn't a question, the custom and use of this committee has been that we will allow people to respond to statements as well. So if you'd like to respond to Representative Bliss's statement, you certainly are welcome to.
Sure. I started writing articles in 1985 or so. My first article appeared in the Star and Tribune on the editorial page calling for a presidential primary.
Mr. Moylan, I do want to just interrupt for just a second. This body is due up in the House floor in 15 minutes. I do have two other testifiers, so okay. Brevity would be helpful.
I will try to be if you look at the body of work, Mr. Blitz or Representative Blitz, excuse me. It is true. I've been critical of this president. You'll find very, very few articles dealing with the legislature or criticisms of the legislature. In that body of work, you'll find articles relating to investor protection, some articles relating to state contracting and how to implement Sarbanes-Oxley. You'll find a variety of articles. The president has caught my attention. I will admit that. That is who I am. I can't deny that. Now, we don't have jurisdiction over the president. So that's that. And I'm sorry if you view my prism as not being the same as yours or similar to yours or identical to yours. It isn't. But that doesn't mean that I can't handle things fairly. And you should know that the enforcement activities of the board constitute only a small part of what the board does.
Mr. Moreland, thank you. We have two more member questions. Representative Quam, followed by Representative Joachim. Excuse me. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And earlier you stated that your role on the board would be representative of your party. And what's wrong with members of the board? Their main function is to be impartial and to place the citizens of the state above and the best of the state. Because frankly, I've met a lot of people on both sides of the aisle that on issues set aside the partisan, and I'm, you know, part of this party, and work for the citizens because that's their duty. And the duty on this board, I don't see as to being, I'm there as a member of my party to make sure my party has its representation. I see it as having a balance so that we have the viewpoints and understanding to be able to do the best solution for the citizens, plus having the understanding of what it is like, because we have past members, what it is like to run in a campaign and making sure that things are clear and fair. So I was taken aback by your response stating that your role is to be your party's representative on that board. And what is your clarification as to your meaning when you stated that your role was to be a member of your party on that board?
I'm sorry, sir, if I misstated something. The statute is set up so that three Republicans get appointed and three Democrats. I've been asked to serve in one of the Democratic seats. That does not mean that I wouldn't do a job looking out for all the citizens of the state. The fundamental duty that the board has is to make sure there's a level of transparency in economic interest statements, lobbyist reports, and in campaign finance. And quite frankly, to date, when matters have come before the board, I usually do not even know if the person's a Democrat or Republican. And I don't even look, because it doesn't matter. Because the duty that you have set as a legislature, sure, for the board members is to make sure that there is this level of disclosure to create confidence in the institution. That's my job. It's not to serve a party. But I've been asked to apply to this position because I'm a Democrat and because the statute requires you to appoint three Democrats and three Republicans.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's more of a comment than a question. I do appreciate your transparency. You're approaching this saying if you expect us to be transparent, we should be expecting you to be transparent. And I do find that refreshing, and I find it quite ironic that it seems this is like we went through this again 2 years ago. It seems like the board is set up to be bipartisan, three Republicans, three Democrats. And it's that way for a reason, so that it can be approach things in a fair and unbalanced and impartial way. And we didn't drag Ms. Lepik, former Representative Lepik's, every vote she ever took as part of the Republican Party, because that doesn't matter. What matters is that they come to the board with their backgrounds and that we know what their backgrounds are. We set up that board for that reason, so that could be three and three. So you, it's hard for me to have you ding somebody because they're coming in and being honest and saying, hey, I'm a Democrat, I'm supposed to fill a Democrat role, but I can be impartial and this is how I view it. they're there for that reason, but he's sitting here telling us that he can be impartial, and frankly, I do believe him, because so much of what the board does doesn't have to deal with parties. It just has to deal with oversight of us, which is extremely important in this day and age. So I was happy to support former Representative Lepik. In fact, I have her office, I found out, from our Secretary of State, Steve Simon, which is pretty awesome. But no, we need to. We have somebody before us that's being open and transparent with us, and we're going to ding them for it. I find that a little distasteful. Thank you.
That is the last member question that I have. Are there any other member questions at this point? What we are going to do is we are going to adjourn for the day, and there will be a day that we'll be meeting next week, and we will take up the vote on the candidates at that point, because I do want people to have an opportunity to reflect on the testimony that both candidates have provided today.
Mr. Chair, we're going to recess for the day.
We are going to adjourn for the day, excuse me.
And come back at another day?
Correct.
Okay,
thank you. And I want people to have ample opportunity, because this is an important consideration, and I do not want to rush this for members. And with that, there are no other member questions. We are adjourned for the day.
Thank you.